This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, December 3rd, 2012. In Kansas City, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up, European governments condemn Israel's decision to build more homes in the West Bank. Hydraulic fracturing continues to expand in the US. We'll hear from Texas landowners fighting injection wells near their property. And President Obama calls on Congress to ratify the UN Convention on Persons with Disabilities, but Republicans may block its passage. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in headlines. Citing security concerns, the United Nations is pulling all non-essential staff out of Syria today and putting those who remain on standby. Russian President Vladimir Putin was in Istanbul today, where he met with Turkey's president, who called on Russia to stop supporting Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Russia says it's not supporting Assad, it just doesn't want to see the past repeated. Putin also opposes NATO deploying Patriot missiles to the Turkey-Syria border, where Syrian airstrikes over the weekend targeting rebel outposts strayed into Turkey. Most civilian flights in and out of Damascus remain canceled today after fighting over the weekend for control of the airport. Internet and phone communications are still working today. They were restored Saturday after a 48-hour shutdown. Congolese troops re-entered Goma today, but M23 rebels remain poised on the outskirts of town. The M23 occupied the provincial capital almost 2 weeks ago, but agreed to retreat ahead of a negotiation deadline today. The move followed UN-imposed sanctions. International pressure was also brought to bear by the UK, which again halted aid to Rwanda because of concerns about its role in the DR Congo conflict. Gloria Kamkar reports.
UK International Development Secretary Justin Greening said that $34 million in aid would not be released after credible and compelling reports reveal that Rwanda's President Paul Kagame's government is providing weapons to the M23 rebels. The money was due to be paid this month. The conflict has led to the displacement of almost 500,000 people in eastern Congo, raising fears of a humanitarian crisis. The UK withheld $26 million in aid in July after an interim report by a UN panel of experts suspected Rwanda's support in the conflict, but the money was restored in September. Rwanda's Foreign Minister Louise Mushikiwabo has expressed disappointment at the UK government's decision. Gloria Kamkar, FSR in Southampton, United Kingdom.
The U.S. has officially expressed deep concern about the situation in DR Congo and blocked $200,000 earmarked for a Rwandan military academy. But the administration has not implemented the Democratic Republic of the Congo Relief Security and Democracy Promotion Act. The law calls for non-humanitarian aid to be halted for any country that acts to destabilize the DRC. The 2006 measure was sponsored by then-Senator Barack Obama. The U.S. sends Rwanda $200 million each year. Egypt's Supreme Judicial Council announced today that it will monitor the polling for the country's proposed new constitution. Judges and attorneys will be assigned and mandated to serve. The referendum is scheduled for December 15th on the draft that's backed by the Muslim Brotherhood and President Mohamed Morsi. The constitution was quickly crafted after Morsi decreed himself beyond judicial reach and was written without input from minority groups or women. The Egyptian Judges Union remains on strike, and many local media outlets say they won't publish tomorrow in protest. Cargo ships are anchored off the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach, California today, as clerical workers continue their strike to prevent job outsourcing. Chris Bennett reports from L.A.
The 800-member office clerical unit of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union has worked without a contract for 2 years and seeks a pay increase of 2.5%. Union Communications Director Craig Merrilee says the strike is not simply about the money. The workers are trying to save their solidly middle-class jobs by preventing company managers from shifting the jobs to lower-wage areas such as Taiwan, Texas, and North Carolina. Merrilee says the strike is about the future of good jobs in the U.S. versus management turning those positions into low-wage junk jobs in other areas. Management negotiators contend that any new contract abolish the practice of feather-bedding or hiring workers during times when there's little work to do. Roughly 40% of all goods imported into the U.S. come through the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa urged both sides to continue negotiations to prevent ripple effects throughout the Southern California and national economies. Chris Bennett, FSRN, Los Angeles.
Saturday was World AIDS Day, and across Canada this week, Indigenous communities are marking Aboriginal AIDS Awareness Week. FSRN's Aaron Lakoff has more.
Native communities in Canada have higher HIV/AIDS infection rates than those in non-Native populations. Events this week in Aboriginal communities are focused on a campaign of getting to zero, with the goal of avoiding all new infections, as well as raising awareness about discrimination and marginalization of AIDS patients. According to a 2011 public health report, Aboriginals accounted for 12% of all new AIDS infections that year, but they only make up around 4% of Canada's overall population. The report also found that Aboriginal people have the highest proportion of HIV infections attributed to injection drug use at 60%. One challenge is improving Aboriginal access to health care, as many remote reservations lack adequate services and often have to fly in doctors from other communities. Aaron Lakoff, FSRN, Montreal.
For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abraham.
I'm Danny Wood in Kansas City. A growing number of countries and world leaders are condemning Israel's announcement that it will build 3,000 new homes in a West Bank settlement expansion. This follows last week's vote at the United Nations General Assembly that gave Palestine non-member status. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called Israel's move an almost fatal blow to the chances of a two-state solution. Israel also announced it will withhold $100 million in taxes collected for the Palestinian Authority and apply it to debt owed for electricity. For more, we're joined by Josh Rubner, National Advocacy Director of the US Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thanks so much for having me.
The British, French, Spanish, and Swedish governments have summoned the Israeli ambassadors in their countries in protest at Israel's decision to approve the new settlement. Germany and Russia have urged Israel not to move forward with building settlements on Palestinian land. How significant is this European reaction, do you think?
I think it's very significant, but more significant is actually the fact of what Israel has done as a response to Palestine getting upgraded membership in the UN by moving forward with plans to build a new settlement in the area known as E1. Basically, what Israel is doing is cutting off Palestinian East Jerusalem from the remainder of the West Bank and also bisecting the West Bank into two, which will basically put the final nail in the coffin of any kind of attempt to establish a contiguous and viable Palestinian state in the future. So it's very significant. And the fact that you're seeing these recallings of ambassadors, I think, shows how displeased Europe is at Israel right now, as was evidenced by the vote on upgrading Palestine status at the UN last week, where you only had one EU country, the Czech Republic, vote against the initiative.
You've mentioned it there a little bit, but can you tell us a little bit more about this area that Israel is attempting to build on?
Right. Basically, what it will do is it will create a contiguous settlement belt between one of Israel's largest settlement blocks in the West Bank, which is called Maale Adumim, and connect that to Israel's illegal settlements in East Jerusalem. So Palestinians living in East Jerusalem will be completely surrounded by Israeli settlements. There'll be no connectivity between East Jerusalem and the rest of the West Bank, which is, of course, the hoped-for capital of a future Palestinian state. And it'll also make it very, very difficult, if not impossible, for Palestinians to move between the northern part of the West Bank and the southern part of the West Bank.
After meeting with the Israeli ambassador to the UK, the Minister for the Middle East, Alistair Burt, said he called on the Israeli government to reverse their decision. Apart from diplomatic pressure and strong statements like this, what options do world leaders really have to stem this settlement building?
Well, I think sanctions are really the only thing that Israel will listen to at this point to stop its illegal behavior. Clearly, the United States exercises a position in the United Nations where it's able to prevent the international community from imposing the types of arms embargoes and comprehensive sanctions that were placed on the apartheid regime in South Africa. But instead of having to go through the UN, global civil society is responding to a Palestinian civil society call for campaigns of boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. For example, we were part of an initiative last week that called on Stevie Wonder to cancel a benefit concert for the Friends of the Israel Defense Forces. And in light of the fact that he was such a staunch opponent of apartheid in South Africa, he responded to those calls from civil society and dropped his performance from this concert.
Just looking a little more at the U.S. reaction, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton called the settlements a setback for peace. But the U.S. also stood by Israel in opposing that U.N. vote for non-member status at the United Nations. What would you like to see the U.S. say and do in response now?
The fact is that this illegal settlement building goes way beyond a setback or an obstacle to peace. And if the United States were serious about putting an end to Israel's illegal settlement construction, then it would halt military aid. It would halt its diplomatic support at the UN like it did last week when it voted against Palestine's upgraded status.
Israel has been retaliating to the UN vote, and it said it would withhold $100 million US dollars in tax money it's collected on behalf of the Palestinian Authority. How do you see this affecting Palestinians in the West Bank, and are there more revenues that you know of that Israel could withhold?
Well, Israel's actually working hand in glove with Congress, because Congress is still holding up nearly $500 million worth of U.S. aid to the Palestinians that was already approved as part of the 2012 budget. And it's really unclear at this point, I think, where the punishment of Palestinians will end. So will Israel go as far as to bring about a collapse of the Palestinian Authority? I think we'll have to wait and see how tightly the screws will be tightened on the Palestinians.
Josh Rubner, National Advocacy Director of the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation. Thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you so much for having me.
The tensions in the Middle East come just weeks after an Israeli assault on the Gaza Strip. Israeli military strikes killed an estimated 150 Palestinians and devastated infrastructure across the occupied territory, while rocket fire into Israel killed 6 people. Hundreds of Gazans continue to recover from injuries during the conflict, including many who were seriously burned. Some medical experts are calling for an investigation into whether Israel used illegal weapons. FSRN's Rami Al-Maghari reports.
At the intensive care unit at Shifa Hospital, medical staff treat a patient badly wounded after an Israeli bombardment on his home. The 40-year-old man from Sabra neighborhood was critically wounded in the face and neck. Staff nurse Mohammed Khail described his injuries.
Central line to monitor the central venous pressure. The left eyes is burned mainly in the upper lids, and all of the face is burned. This spot's known as shrapnels. There is deeply in the body, deeply. It's cutting all the chest and the abdomen.
Another of those wounded is Abu Jamal, injured following an Israeli drone strike in eastern Khan Yunis. Another man was killed in the same attack. Abu Jamal says his injuries are extensive.
I was wounded directly in my legs and abdomen. I underwent an artery transplant surgery from my right leg to my left leg. Also, I had fractures in both of my legs. Therefore, they installed some metal plates into my legs.
Some health experts are concerned about the weapons Israel used during November's attacks. Dr. Ashraf Al-Qidra is a spokesperson for the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza.
According to the types of injuries we saw, I believe that Israel employed unconventional weapons that caused burns of second or third degrees. Their weapons have caused the amputation of upper and lower limbs of the wounded and caused bodies of the dead to be torn apart.
Human rights groups in Gaza are still examining what weapons Israel used during last month's attacks, but they lack specialized labs to test evidence and are calling on international medical bodies to help in their investigation. Samir Zakut is a chief researcher with the Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights. He says Israel has used controversial weapons in the past.
In the aftermath of Israeli Operation Cast Lead in 2009, for example, we had remnants of weapons. Experts who came over to Gaza then proved that those remnants contained some very dangerous poisonous radiation. And the experts advised we keep those remnants away from populated areas, for they cause health complications in the long run.
According to the Gaza-based health ministry, Israeli airstrikes last month left nearly 1,400 Palestinians wounded, including 50 critically. That figure includes 450 children, 220 women, and 155 elderly. Rami Al-Mighari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
Today marks the 20th annual International Day of Persons with Disabilities. A declaration from President Obama called on everyone in the US to observe the holiday by pushing for the ratification of the UN Convention on Persons with Disabilities. The Senate is scheduled to vote on the international treaty on Tuesday, but opposition from a handful of Republicans threatens its passage. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
The UN treaty seeks to raise global standards for services, treatment, and accessibility for people with disabilities. Negotiated by President George W. Bush in 2006 and signed by President Obama in 2009, the convention would make the U.S. part of a newly formed committee that evaluates policies and infrastructure around the world and makes suggestions for improvement. But several Republican senators, led by Utah's Mike Lee, are opposing the convention's ratification, saying the creation of this committee would threaten U.S. sovereignty. Backed by some parents' rights groups and conservative think tanks, including the Homeschool Legal Defense Association and the Heritage Foundation, opponents say the treaty would allow the UN to dictate how parents care for children with disabilities. Massachusetts Democrat John Kerry, chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, responded to this argument at a press conference Monday.
It is a committee with zero power. It is a committee that makes a recommendation. And that's it. And to suggest that Americans cannot accept advice from some kind of a committee somewhere or make our own judgments about what a committee might suggest is ridiculous.
Yet the opposition to the bill's passage goes beyond the text itself. Some of the convention's critics, including Senator Lee, say they would oppose taking up any international treaty during the lame duck session. Lee explained why in a speech to his colleagues.
It is very important to make sure that we have a full understanding of what these treaties mean. If it is true that it's too fast to move something like this or another treaty through during the lame duck session, it's also too fast to do it now.
36 Republicans have joined Lee in pledging to vote no on this or any other international convention before a new Congress takes office in January, enough to block the bill's passage in this week's vote. On Monday, Senator Kerry urged these lawmakers to change their minds, saying they've had 3 years already to examine the text of the treaty, and more delay would hurt Americans with disabilities.
A lame duck session isn't something different. It's another session of Congress. And it includes the very same people who have done all the work on this treaty. The people who held the hearings, went to the hearings, listened to it, have read the report. The members of this Congress are the ones who should vote.
The treaty has some Republican support from former Kansas Senator Bob Dole, former Attorney General Dick Thornburg, and Arizona Senator John McCain. McCain has been rallying veteran rights groups to support the treaty's passage and invited Afghanistan veteran Dan Brzezinski to Monday's event. Brzezinski lost both of his legs to an improvised explosive device, or IED, and now walks with prosthetics. He said the treaty would make it much easier for him and millions of other Americans to travel and work in other countries.
The advantages we take for granted here at home that allow people like me to live fulfilling, independent lives don't exist in much of the rest of the world. 8 short months after being wounded, I joined a few friends in a trip to South Africa to watch the World Cup. While I should have been enjoying this once-in-a-lifetime trip, I was constantly worried about my ability to get around. Would the restaurant have an accessible bathroom, or would I have to go without? Would the lobby at the hotel have an accessible doorway, or would I have to get carried into the lobby?
To pass any international treaty, two-thirds of the Senate need to vote in favor. Because Illinois Republican Mark Kirk remains on leave with health problems, that would mean this convention needs 66 votes to pass. When they voted last week to bring the bill to the floor, they only had 61. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
World leaders began the second and final week of COP18 climate change negotiations in Doha, Qatar today. One of the goals of many participants is to extend the Kyoto Protocol, the only legally binding agreement to curb emissions, which is expiring at the end of the year. The United States has never ratified the treaty. Like recent gatherings, pressure is growing on rich countries to make stronger commitments to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Sam Smith is with WWF's Climate and Energy Initiative. She says recent extreme weather events should be a wake-up call.
This issue is about the difference between science and political science, and between reality and the parallel universe that is these negotiations. Just to make it a little more clear, in 2010, Russia suffered an enormous heat wave. 50 to 70,000 people died in that heat wave. And scientists are telling us this year that it was very clearly linked to climate change. This year in the northern summer, the wheat growing areas of the Ukraine, Russia, and the United States suffered from droughts and extreme heat all at the same time, and food prices spiked, and we are now teetering on the edge of the third global food crisis since 2008.
Many have been optimistic that the U.S. might take a stronger stance in Doha following the re-election of President Obama. But at a press conference today, U.S. climate envoy Todd Stern said not to expect a major change in tone from the U.S. Instead, he said, the Obama administration has already made significant accomplishments and is on track to meet a 16% reduction in emissions through current policies that are already in place.
The president has put in place very significant regulations on the whole transportation side, taking the miles per gallon of our vehicles from around 27 to over 54 over the course of about a 12-year period, and we're in the middle of that right now. Important steps forward with respect to regulations on power plants under regulations that have been put in place essentially can't use coal unless new power plants unless those emissions can be captured.
Stern also attributed U.S. natural gas production to lowered U.S. emissions, but that practice has provoked concerns in places where residents are dealing with the consequences of hydraulic fracturing or fracking. Fracking wells have grown at a record pace in the U.S. Across shale regions like the Bakken in North Dakota, the Barnett in North Texas, and the Eagle Ford in South Texas, oil and gas companies are swooping in to start drilling. But there's growing opposition, not just from environmentalists, but local landowners. Andrew Oxford reports from Austin.
When Marathon drills you a well, they're going to have to be able to get rid of that water somewhere, aren't they?
Well, that's the thing. I think there's a better way.
I'm sitting in a big, windowless hearing room on the 12th floor of a nondescript office building right down the street from the state capitol. It's the Texas Railroad Commission, but they have nothing to do with railroads and everything to do with oil and gas. The agency is responsible for regulating energy production across the state. That is why Robert Sinclair is here with his neighbor, Nolan Jonas. The two are fighting an application by an oil field services company called Stallion to build a wastewater injection well right next to their properties.
The oil wells isn't the problem.
That's Nolan Jonas. He has lived on his ranch near Karnes City for more than 30 years and now finds himself in the middle of the fracking boom sweeping South Texas.
With the fracking, they push water in there and they pull the water back out. But with the injection wells, they're forcing more and more water in the ground. Naturally, it's not clean water. And the concern is that it finds a crack in the formation and goes into the drinking water source.
Stelian plans to build an industrial facility within a half a mile of Jonas's home that could pump dirty water used by nearby fracking wells more than 6,000 feet underground. Robert Sinclair bought his ranch next to the proposed site back in 2008. He worries about who will be responsible if something goes wrong, and if companies like Stelian are really prepared for an accident.
What happens if they have a big environmental spill? They just file bankruptcy. You have no recourse. They ruin your land, your investment, the community. They ruin the aquifer. And it's just, you know, well, we're sorry. We followed the rules by the Railroad Commission.
Since much of the job for regulating the oil and gas industry falls to states, the Railroad Commission is responsible for inspecting wells across Texas, ensuring energy companies are operating safely, and setting rules for the sector. But Jonas is concerned the Railroad Commission may not be enforcing those rules anyway.
I feel they're understaffed and they just don't have enough inspectors out there.
So can residents of boomtowns like Karnes City count on the oil and gas companies moving in right next door? Sharon Wilson, a blogger from North Texas and organizer with Earthworks, is not so sure.
The industry is fabulous at externalizing their costs and passing them on to the taxpayers and the residents in the area.
A study released by Earthworks in September suggested the Railroad Commission was overwhelmed by the growth of the oil and gas sector in Texas. Inspectors, according to the report, could not keep up with the new wells being drilled. When regulators did find companies in violation of the law, they rarely referred those violations to the Railroad Commission for enforcement action. That concerns those who have seen oil and gas companies move into their neighborhoods. What will the companies do if there is a leak or water is contaminated?
They'll go bankrupt and eventually restructure and have a different name and start over again, doing the same thing somewhere else.
In fact, the company hoping to drill next door to Sinclair and Jonas is a good example. The injection well was originally proposed by a company called Salties, which was acquired by Stelian Oilfield Services in 2007. Stelian filed for bankruptcy in 2009, then emerged less than 4 months later, restructured. While corporations have tools like this to stay afloat, for the residents, Wilson says it is not so simple.
An ordinary citizen is going to have a really hard time fighting an oil and gas company in court.
But the two neighbors from Karnes County are not alone. More than 400 wastewater injection wells have been drilled across Texas this year. Now Jonas and Sinclair are waiting to hear from the Railroad Commission what will become of the land next door, and, perhaps, the water under their feet.
We gave it our best shot. That's
David
all we
can and
do.
Goliath.
Yeah, that's right.
Andrew Oxford, FSRN, Austin.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor, Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In Kansas City, standing in for Dorian Marina, I'm Danny Wood.